Hey everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Caution Wide Right. It's just another trucking podcast. With me today, we have some great guests, Matt Whitmer and Andrew Walker from Shipley Energy. Shipley is a natural gas, propane, heating oil transport company serving commercial and residential customers across central PA, eastern Pennsylvania, regionally in the East Coast too. Matt Whitmer, he's the manager of transportation operations. After working his way up from fuel driver, dispatch, and in his position today at Shipley, Andrew Walker is safety and environmental manager with over 25 years of experience in safety and operations in hazmat logistics experience specifically, working as VP of risk management at United Petroleum Transports, VP of HSE with Bridger Companies, also serving on the board of directors with Oklahoma Trucking Association, president of Oklahoma Safety Management Council, much more. I think on the safety council with ATA, National Tank Truck Carriers. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So to start things off, Matt, we talked a quick little bit about your bio, but so much experience and background here. When you first got your CDL, I'm curious, did you ever think you'd haul hazmat?
No, no chance. If you would have told me I was 20 years ago that I was going to be driving a truck at some point, I would have told you you were crazy. But no, I never thought I'd be driving hazmat. The opportunity presented itself, something different than what I'd done in the past. And to this day, it's my favorite job I've had.
Very cool. And what got you in the trucking industry?
So I actually graduated college in 2008, had trouble finding the job with the mini recession we had going on, ended up with a company, a beer wholesaler, and started there just helping out in delivery trucks. And they actually would pay you to train to get your license. Not in the sense we do it now. You could actually just get your permit and go out and drive.
Yep.
So got it that way. Drove there for 6 years and then ended up at Shipley.
So beer distribution company, does that make you a beer aficionado? Do you have a favorite beer?
No, I actually don't drink a lot of beer anymore.
Quality testing.
At the time, there was quite a bit. But no, not so much anymore. But
that's fun. That's fun. And then from you were a driver for a bit, mm-hmm. dispatch to managing drivers. I was curious about your experience. How was that transition for you?
It was actually more seamless than you would think. I was already pretty computer savvy, obviously graduating from college and everything, so that helped me out. But knowing going out and driving the routes and then coming in and trying to make the routes goes a long way towards making an efficient schedule for not only the company but for the driver themselves too. So you have not only profitability but you have happy drivers too.
Right.
So that actually went pretty quick. We had a kind of a transition when I came into the office where a dispatch team of six went down to two, being me of one of them after my first week. So it was a lot of hours, a lot of getting your feet wet. Felt like I had about 3 years of experience in about 6 months. So, but that transition, and you know, then you have the rapport with the drivers because they know you've been out there and
right
with them. They're going to be more likely to work hard for you because they know that you know what they're going through.
So. Exactly. Very cool. Well, okay, Andrew, it's your turn. Andy,
sure.
I was just curious, what got you first in the safety side of the operations, especially with the hazmat logistics?
Well, I had started out, I got a job with a company called Seaboard, which is, you may see their things around. They have, container ships and containers and things like that. I actually worked on their agricultural side in Western Oklahoma, and I was dispatching animal movements. I worked for Seaboard Pork, and we had a processing plant, 5,000 employees, and we raised all of our own pigs, so it was completely vertically integrated. And we had 900 trucks driving pigs around from farm to farm, and so I dispatched. I only got that job because I had a minor in Spanish, and more than 95% of the people that worked at Seaboard spoke Spanish only. Like, it was just, you know, a lot of immigrant workers and migrant worker types.
Yeah.
And you had to be at least functional in Spanish to get along there. So 2 days a week, 2.5 days a week, I would dispatch animal movements. There wasn't enough to do to keep you busy for 5 days. So they were like, well, why don't you go out to the farms and do safety? I didn't know anything about safety. And I did that for a few years and really polished up my Spanish skills. I ended up taking a job with a company called Grondyke Transport based in Enid, Oklahoma, pretty big hazmat carrier. And I got a field safety job because I'd had some trucking with the dispatch and I'd had some safety, you know, doing the farm safety stuff. And that's really how I got into it. I'm like Matt, if I went to college and if you had told me I was going to be a career safety person, I would have chuckled because I never wore my seatbelt. I drove, you know, like a bat out of hell. And then that's just not the direction that, you know, my life took me. But yeah, that's how I got into it. And it's just been a gradual progression from there.
So safety manager today, what does your day-to-day, week-to-week look like? I know your position can be, I mean, really hundreds of different types of things that you're involved with. What does that look like?
Well, so we have bulk plants where we store our own fuel, several million gallons of storage. There's, you know, a pretty heavy amount of regulation and maintenance that goes with those.
Yeah.
My team oversees the bulk plants, in particular the maintenance and the upkeep and the regulatory aspect of it. So that's a huge part of the job. Of course, we do the safety stuff, the compliance, like you know, everybody's accustomed to. But it also means working with our executive leadership team to develop our risk profile.
Right.
Well, you know, what is our risk assessment and what is our tolerance for risk? Then I have to translate that into how are we going to address it with our insurance coverage?
Yep.
And so that's a big project. I think renewing our insurance every year is a 6-month project for me.
Yeah.
Starts in October and it just ends on April 1. And that's a hard deadline. So I spend a lot of time with that. With that also comes dealing with any legal issues that arise that involve, you know, an injury or a loss or an environmental claim. Now, you know, personnel issues, I don't deal with those legally, but everything else I get. So I testify, I get deposed, I do lots of fun stuff like that on a day-to-day basis. It keeps me hopping.
And there's plenty that we'll dive deeper into. I am curious, hauling pigs and that background. There's a movie that we've been floating around the office for a while that I'm trying to get everybody to watch is Space Truckers, 80s movie where they haul square pigs. I'm just curious, floating it up. I've never seen it. No, no.
I haven't seen it. They would, you could fit more of those in a trailer than that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Seem like, yeah.
They're square pigs because they fit inside the cage. Like, they're square cage. Oh, it's hilarious. But a must-watch movie that I'm trying to pitch to everybody to go check out. But
I'm sure somebody somewhere is working on that. You know, we had geneticists and everybody working at Seaboard. Like, I mean, it was a complicated system, and it was amazing. Like, you couldn't go to a meeting. You might be in a meeting with 3 or 4 PhDs and then a couple veterinarians and then a pig farmer.
Right.
You know, so it was a really interesting way to work.
Now, and I'm curious too, so government's ending the COVID emergency requirements. You were both, I think in your positions currently when the pandemic hit. What was those 3 years like?
So I had just taken my rollover, so it was there was a lot of change. You know, I remember preparing 15-day packets of materials for the dispatcher just in case we needed it, you know, and turned into two of my dispatchers now full-time remote. It was difficult, especially learning the job, taking over that role, and we had just brought somebody in to replace me and trying to get them trained up during COVID and that dynamic, and then trying to make sure that we had enough work because, you know, it was driving, so delivering gas stations and all that, you know, we slowed down considerably. So it was difficult to navigate, but I was still getting my feet wet at the time, trying to learn as much as I could about the new role. And it was challenging, to say the least.
And it was hard working with drivers during that time. Really, not just working with drivers, but we had a pandemic team, and I'm responsible for our pandemic plan. And when I started with Shipley in 2017, but in this position in 2019,
right before the pandemic.
And, you know, I had it on my list of to-dos. Let's update the, you know, we called it a bird flu plan from the old days. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know that that's a big, huge priority. And lo and behold, man, I wish I had done it. I ended up doing it like hurried version right when it started. But we put our pandemic team together. And one of the immediate challenges that came up, particularly when it came to the vaccination, was, you know, what position do you take?
Right.
Because ideally we want people to get vaccinated so they can come to work and do those things, but you cannot account for the philosophies and the beliefs of every, you can't, one, there's no one size fits all.
Yep.
And the question that constantly came up was, what do we do policy wise with our company and our team that doesn't alienate half of them? And we were really, really legitimately afraid that if we made the wrong decision, we could lose 50% of our drivers.
Right.
And that is, you know, a death knell for a company. You can't lose a big chunk of your drivers like that. So we spent many, many hours in discussions about what we're going to do and how we're going to approach it. We ended up trying to incentivize people to get the vaccination. So you get vaccinated, you get an extra day of PTO or something along those lines.
Right.
But never punishing people who opted out.
Right.
So, and that way we kept our drivers, we were able to keep going. But man, it was a tough time. Unprecedented. Nobody had any experience at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the same thing. I mean, it just even home life in general was just crazy. So just managing on the, and you guys manage, I mean, there's what, like over 100 CDL drivers, potentially another 100 or so non-CDL drivers or safety positions
right
out there. I'm curious. So today, our CDL school, we have a job board at cnstrains.com, and we share your job postings on our site as well. And I was curious, what should drivers, like, why should drivers look into Shipley, working for Shipley, and what are the credentials, or what does their resume need to look like to be able to work there?
So on my side, where we do all the Class A tanker trucks, first things first, when I'm interviewing a driver or a potential candidate to be a driver, I want to make sure, honestly, I'm trying to find out the culture. We have a good group right now of drivers, and world-class is what word we always use, and they are just from top to bottom, always willing to go the extra mile. And, you know, whenever we have somebody new come in, I give them a list of all our drivers. I said, you can call any one of these guys and they'll put you in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's trying to how to get into a station or, you know, issue with the trailer. I said, these guys will be able to help you out. And they just do an incredible job. So after the culture fit, obviously, like, what kind of experience do they have? We don't necessarily look for people that have fuel experience, because
we almost prefer that, right, they don't,
because then you can train them. They might come with bad habits from other companies, right, that you can't coach out or be more difficult to coach out.
Yeah.
We prefer people to have driving experience, being that it's hazmat, it's, you know, a lot of liability on the line, but we'll take people that don't have experience. And we actually just had a career IT professional transition over, and he's got the right attitude. He checks all the boxes. It's like, well, we can work with that. You know, we'll take somebody like, you know, a mold of, you know, ball of clay and put, you know, mold them into what we want. Yep. And, you know, so that's where the culture piece, and then, you know, a little bit of experience if possible. And then we're not afraid to take chances on people that don't have an industry experience. Like, when I came in, I didn't have it. So they took a chance on me and it, you know, worked out. So I'm always willing to take that chance on somebody else.
And from the safety perspective, first of all, I mean, at Shipley, we really do follow this rule. Like, safety has complete veto power over anybody before they get hired. So if I or someone in my department takes a look at your background and says, "Now, these things are a problem," it's a no, then it's a no.
Right.
And that's more a company policy thing that's really helpful for us. For a driver or somebody listening to this who's thinking about applying, what we look for on the nuts and bolts side of it are people who are rule followers, right? If you're a rule follower and you take pride in what you do, then you're teachable. Because as Matt made a really good point, we're going to have to teach you quite a bit. And what we can't have happen is somebody who's not a good learner. Or, I mean, it doesn't mean you have to be a book smart person or a classroom type person. Matt and I both went to college, but many, many people in our company did not.
Right.
But the thing is, like, if we teach you to do it a certain way and you think you know a better way, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to be a problem. So people who follow the rules when they're hauling hazmat and dangerous goods, that's really, really important. And that's the first thing we look for. And the way we look for that is we use their PSP in the background. I'm not so worried about a speeding violation on somebody's MVR, right? I mean, as long as there's not a ton of them or they're not crazy outrageous, everybody gets grabbed for speeding at some point. We all get that. That didn't tell me anything about you.
Yeah.
But what tells me about you is if I see on your PSP two different times you've got a seatbelt violation, nobody on earth made you not wear your seatbelt. Yep. There is no delivery so time sensitive and no dispatcher, Matt, that's such a bully that you have to hurry so fast that you can't take 1 second to buckle your seatbelt. You don't wear your seatbelt in the face of overwhelming evidence that it's safer and better to do so.
Right.
If you just can't do that, that tells me that you probably think you're going to do it your way and your way's better. And when we're telling you how to handle 8,000 gallons of hazmat, you know, we need you to really understand this is how it has to be done. We don't have problems because the process fails. We have problems because we fail to follow the process.
Right.
Right. So if you follow the process, you're going to be fine. And that applies beyond Shipley. If somebody teaches you a process as a driver, follow that process. Yeah. Right. Because if you're looking for a better way to do it, inevitably you're probably looking for a faster way when you should be looking at a more thorough way. Like, it's qualitative versus quantitative. Quantitative, and I can get more done faster. But that's going to lead to problems. That's what causes corner cutting. Mm-hmm. So the qualitative side is, how safely can I do this? Or
right.
or how properly can I do this? And that's the mindset we're trying to set. So when we see things that lead us to think that you think the rules don't apply to you, we'll find somebody else because you're not going to be a good fit. So the easiest thing is a drug or alcohol conviction. You have something like that with the CDL, you know you can't do that. And you don't respect the rules. You know when you get your CDL, I can't have medical marijuana, you know, a DUI is a 0.04. Like, I can't have any of these problems or I'm not going to have a career. And if you think that you can do it on the weekend and get away with it, that means you don't respect the rules right. or the process. So those are the things we look for really in terms of disqualifying factors for somebody, you know, that serves us well, you know. I mean, it's not the traditional things I think most people look for.
Why worry about it? Use trusted and certified collectors from our collection sites. At CNS, we have our own collection sites and are a certified consortium and third-party administrator, or a CETPA. Our experts ensure that all DOT rules and regulations are followed, including the implementation of random drug tests for you and your drivers, updating your company drug testing policies, record retention, and document purge management. We can even help you find which drug test site to go to anywhere across the U.S. So join our consortium today. For more information, contact us at 800-551-9816. We also help with oral testing and customized policy development. If you have any questions or want to learn more, click the link below or visit us at cnsocmed.com to learn more. I'm curious too, so if they eventually get through that pre-employment process and you have the onboarding, you mentioned a little bit, Matt, about the company culture side of it. How do you build company culture, especially through that onboarding process?
I like to find out what they like to do outside of work, too.
Yeah.
Talk to them about people, you know, see what they're, you know, are they single, family, and those factors don't decide whether or not they're a good driver. But just see what they're about, see what they're into. If you find out they're into a certain activity, then maybe you're maybe you're not as likely to bring them on board, or they might be a risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
Different avenues like that. You know, how do they talk? Do they show respect? Are they going to get along with the dispatchers, the team? Just how are they going to fit within that, being that a key in the cog, basically? So
your culture is a tough thing. And pandemic was the other thing that really killed, made culture tough for us. It was people working from home. We literally have half as many people at our corporate office as we did prior to the pandemic. We have more people working for the company, but just less in the office. And so the things that we would do to build culture in that situation, we don't necessarily get to do. But I agree with Matt. Like, we want to get to know you and to know about you. And there is true, honest, sincere care from starting with our owner, Bill Shipley, through our executive leadership team. They really, truly do care about you, and they care about your work-life balance. Like, that's a shock to say that our CEO cares about your work-life balance, and he does not want you to work yourself to death, and he wants you to be there for your family. So we try to do all the things that everybody else does. We have, you know, truck driver appreciation week and cookouts and recognition and all those things. That doesn't make us stand out from anybody else. I think when somebody runs into a challenge and they find that Shipley is there for them, which does happen, then that's the eye-opening experience. And I hate that someone has to, you know, have some kind of hardship in life before they realize how good they have it at work.
Yes.
But there's no other way to really create that.
No. And I think, like, my job prior to here, it was much different. It was a small family-owned business, but at the base of it, they didn't care about the people. And that's true. And then you come to a bigger company like Shipley, and from the top down, they really do care, you know. And me, intrinsically, that's how I am anyway. But you push that along to your drivers. Like, when I have a conversation with them, one of the first questions is, how are you doing? How's your family? Yeah. You know, and that keeps people here. You know, I feel like it helps keep people here because we do care about you, you know. Whereas, you know, at some of the bigger companies, you might just be a number. And we have – Shipley's a bigger company, don't get me wrong. But internally between each department, it feels like a smaller company. It's broken down to where everybody can hopefully get that hands-on, one-on-one experience and feel like they're part of something and not just a number.
And that's awesome. You know, like you said, especially for a decent-sized company – I mean, driver retention, the biggest reason that people complain is either communication, not having your back, being a number, are sort of like those three main things. So it's awesome to hear, I mean, the praises coming from your company. You've mentioned to me off camera that you've got drivers that have been there for many decades.
Mm-hmm. We have some 50-year drivers.
Yeah.
I mean, more than a handful of 30-year drivers.
Yeah.
This isn't true anymore because we've grown, so we've added some people. But 2 years ago, I could tell somebody when they came on board that we had more 50-year drivers than one-year drivers, right? Like, that's crazy incredible. To think about. That's not true anymore because we've grown quite a bit in the last 2 or 3 years, and we've had to expand and hire some more people. So we do have some newer guys. But that was a true statement, and it's hard to believe. You know, and you talk about the big thing, the things that drivers find important. You know, we start with the blocking and tackling, like the 101, get their paycheck right.
Right. Oh, seriously.
We start with getting your paycheck right, and you never have to worry about whether your paycheck's going through, you're going to get paid. And then if you have any questions, there's always somebody there. We do have I call it smile and dial. We have a smile and dial policy kind of at Shipley. Anything that you don't know about, I mean, anything. That you're out there, you don't know what to do in a situation, or you're not sure if this is where this fuel goes, that whatever it is, that doesn't seem right. You're making a delivery to the house and there's a dog in the yard. Like, anything you don't know, smile and dial. Pick up the phone and call. And the Shipley point of view is, you're not bothering us. We're here to help. We do this as a team. And it applies to their home life and their benefits and their job. So I mean, I think people get comfortable with that. And if that's what they're interested in, then they find a home at Shipley. They stay. They don't leave.
Very cool. Very cool. And I know a lot of drivers or potential people getting into the industry, one of the things they love so much is the truck itself, the new trucks, whatever it is. I did see on your website, Shipley's committed to offsetting 50% of operational carbon footprint by 2025. I was curious on the truck side, how's transportation helping with that process?
We actually have 5 of our trucks are CNG, compressed natural gas. They present their own challenges, but it's great to be able to know that we're helping with that, you know, that carbon footprint a little bit. They present some challenges where we have to route them a little different. There's only three areas we can get, or three stations we can get fuel at in the central Pennsylvania area. One in York that we own and operate, one in Lancaster, and then there's a truck stop in Carlisle where we can get fuel.
Yeah.
So it really presents some challenges. You got to make sure that we keep the guys within 300 miles or less, or make sure they're in one of those areas that they can get fuel in. But it's great to know that we can help do our job where we're delivering diesel fuel, gasoline, but still be able to help the environment at the same time.
And with a CNG truck, I'm just curious about, is the pre-trip a little bit different? What are they looking for with that kind of a truck?
There's really no difference in pre-trip. You're still checking your fluids. You know, the trailer has its own pre-trip process, but you're still going to do the same thing there. The one difference is you're going to check there's a pressure gauge to show how much CNG you have, and it might not always mesh up one-to-one with the fuel gauge.
Sure.
Because you want to make sure that the pressure gauge is up around 4,000. If not, you may want to top off before you get started. You know, just to make sure that you're not going to run out of fuel. But,
and does that add extra weight to the truck as well? Does that limit?
It does, actually. Yeah. So it takes down our hauling capacity from about 8,500 gallons,
okay,
give or take, to 8,200 gallons.
Okay.
And in Maryland, we can only do 8,000 gallons.
Oh, interesting.
So there's a regulation within Pennsylvania that you can get an exemption for a CNG truck to haul that extra 200 gallons.
Yeah, I know EV trucks, same thing. They can go 80,000 up to 82,000 with EV. Battery packs are heavier than that. But
Right. So that affects our profitability a little bit, not being able to haul those extra 300 gallons. But all in all, they're good trucks.
Very cool. And I'm just curious about the maintenance, too. So the tanks themselves, I know just in general, looking at, you know, the whether it's residential or if people have tanks during the summertime, they get low, they can fill up with sludge, things like that. What's the maintenance process look like on the trucks at your end?
On the CNG trucks?
CNG or just the tankers themselves?
We don't run into a lot of issue
on
that end at all, honestly. Not that I remember.
Well, on the tanks themselves, not the. I'll have to let you talk about the CNG.
Yeah,
CNG, I don't, nothing different. Yeah, I don't deal with that very much. But with a hazmat tanker, there's a whole litany of inspections that have to be done depending on what the build of that trailer is and what it's designed to carry.
Right.
Those are called HM-183 inspections. And we have to keep track of those and make sure they're done. If it's not done in the set amount of time that it's required, that vehicle's out of service.
Right.
And there are plenty of like stop gaps. You could drive it up the road, but if you got to a loading facility, that trailer has to be
paper tested.
Well, but it's going to be registered with that loading facility.
Okay.
And they're going to have that date, and they're going to go, oh, nope, that's past date. You can't load that trailer.
Right.
And that would be a hassle for us, but. And these are expensive inspections. I mean, there's a visual, which is easy, but there's an internal test, and that requires three people, and they're going to get inside and not just look at the inside of the tanker, but actually X-ray welds, some things like that. It's a big thing. There's a leakage test and a pressure test.
Yeah.
If the tanker has a liner, which some chemical tankers have a liner, they've got to inspect that. They inspect the upper coupler, which is what connects, you know, houses the kingpin. They got to pull that down, inspect it, X-ray it. It takes a significant amount of class time to get certified as an HM-183 inspector, and then 2 full years, so 2,080 hours over, you know, per year, so 4,160 hours, I guess, of working full time on hazmat tankers only.
Wow.
To be certified to sign off on one of those inspections. So we don't, consequently, in most companies, don't have an internal person that does that.
Right.
That's a risk that we deflect and hire a specialist for. So we'll get those inspections done elsewhere, but they've got to be done, and it makes you keep those trailers up. And you can run them for, if you do that, you can run that equipment for eons. I had, in my past, I had a propane trailer that was built in the early 1950s. It was still the 2010s, and we were running it.
I was going to ask, is there a lifetime for those trailers?
If it passes the...
We've got quite a few that I think are from the 90s.
Yeah.
We actually have a couple asphalt trailers. Well, not a couple. I think there's only one at this point. That was a 74.
Yeah.
And it still passed inspection. It still runs well.
And asphalt's technically non-haz, so the inspections don't necessarily apply. It depends on the type of asphalt, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, if you take care of your equipment, you can run it for...
Right.
For quite a while, and then the engineering doesn't change that much. It has a little. I mean, I bore you with the engineering stuff that's changed, but they look the same.
Right.
Like if you keep it clean and polished and nice, nobody's going to know that truck or trailer was built in '98 unless they get over there and look at the spec plate.
Yeah.
I mean, it just looks nice running down the road. All right, let's go.
Some of the internal workings are a little older, but
it may be cable actuated instead of air, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But it still looks
nice. To see it, yeah.
Well, and so this comes down to also, so you need for CDL drivers a tanker endorsement, hazmat endorsement. Explain a little bit. We talked a little bit again off air too. The sort of the tanker side of it. We have a truck simulator downstairs. Whether it's that reaction of wanting to sharp turn, do a quick turn, and then you can potentially roll over, things like that. Talk a little bit about that.
So the biggest danger spot really with a tanker, and you hear this a lot when you're prepping for the test, is slosh and surge.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how to shift smoothly, and I had a CDL for 15 years too, and I've driven and owned some trucks and been an owner operator, so Matt and I kind of have a little of that in common. But he's way better than I ever was. But if you don't know how to shift properly, and if you get to a 50% loaded level, that's the most dangerous okay. position, right? So 100% loaded, which you should never be 100% loaded because you need to leave a little headspace. But 100% loaded, the slosh and surge isn't as powerful because there's nowhere really for that product to go.
Yep.
It can't move forward and backward or up and down the walls very much. But when it's at 50% loaded and you brake hard, it all comes forward. It can knock you right through the intersection even though you've stopped.
Yeah.
Or if you make a curve, inevitably what happens to guys and girls is they make a turn, and if they turn the way they've always turned in their personal vehicle or maybe even in a box truck, they have a tendency to break through the curve. Mm-hmm. And if you break through the curve in a tanker, you're in trouble.
Yep.
Right? Because as you continue to break, that product slides at the side. So what we have to teach people with a tanker is a good practice no matter what you're doing. Slow down a little bit below the speed you're going to take the curve before you get to it,
yeah.
and then gently accelerate through the curve. And if you do that, you will manage the slosh and surge. But it can happen. You can slide around and be a little bit out of control, and that product will climb right up, and you won't feel it. It rolls over, not all at once. It does like it kind of whips like a towel. Like if it goes over, the trailer will go over and be almost all the way over before you and the truck
realize
it. And then the next thing you get whipped over real hard.
Oh.
And that's the way it works, even if you're going slow. So it can be a scary situation, and really has to do with managing driving a tanker properly. And it's like even more pronounced if you're hauling milk, because there's no baffles. Right. It's a smooth bore trailer. Like with us, what we do in fuel, there are bulkheads in that trailer.
Right.
There might be four or five different compartments, and that will arrest a lot of the movement of the product, so it's not as pronounced.
Some of those even have baffles in them yet too for extra. Because right. I knew that was one of my biggest concerns when I switched from, dry packaging to liquid. I was like, you read in the book,
those beer cans don't slosh. Yeah, right, surge. Yeah.
you read in the book, it's like talking about the surge, and I'm like, okay. And I honestly never felt a difference driving sure. a gas tanker. I never felt that. I know the guys when they drive the asphalt, because asphalt's one big tank as well, and propane too, will feel it a little bit more than I never felt it. But
so I'm curious on the driver training side. Obviously, your guys' safety record is impeccable, especially compared to national averages and things like that. What are you doing on driver training? I don't know. Do you have weekly, monthly safety meetings, video training? What are you doing to train drivers, whether it's being safe, but also, again, preparing for potential issues that happen down the road, whether it's their fault or not?
Well, we have quite a few training things that we do. We started at the beginning. We started just in the last year, mm-hmm. Certified trainer system, so that a new hire comes in, they get onboarded, and then they get assigned to a certified trainer with us. So this person's been through a train-the-trainer course. Yep. We have a bunch of dedicated things that we want to teach and a manual that they teach from. It's not they sit there and read the manual, but that the manual explains these are our processes. Because we talked about process and following the process, yeah. and that's the important thing. And they don't get released to dispatch until that trainer signs them off and yep. says, this person's ready to go, and we feel comfortable with it. If that trainer says, this person can't do it, that trainer doesn't get questioned. Yep. We do have a process where we'll put them with another certified trainer to verify,
yep.
just to take out any personality issues or whatever the case may be. But if our trainers tell us we don't have faith that this person can do the job, then we're not going to operate that person. I have a nightmare story from my past where a company I was at did not do that, and it resulted in the fatality of the trainee, and because the trainers got overruled, and it wrecked some lives. Like, I mean, it was really, really difficult situation. So, we don't want that to happen. We're not going to let that happen. Beyond that... We do some ongoing training. We do a big training class every year because we tend to be seasonal with our residential right. delivery. Matt's not seasonal, but the bulk of our deliveries are. So before the season starts, we'll have a big 4-hour training class every year that everybody goes to, even Matt's guys. Mm-hmm. We do probably once a quarter some specialized training of some kind for those that, you know, depends on who it is that may need it. There's always some ongoing training that we're doing. We will do it internally. We'll bring outside, you know, subject matter experts in. We'll bring DOT officer in to teach.
That's cool.
Or we'll bring in a crane operating expert to teach, because our propane technicians are lifting propane tanks with cranes. And, you know, and that's in and of itself very dangerous. And it's not a skill that I have. I couldn't teach it.
Right.
And only Matt could teach it. And so we bring somebody in from the outside to teach that and go through it. So, you know, if you're not staying on top of those things, then you open the door for people to just, and this is going to sound bad, but to just do the best they know how.
Right.
And when somebody's relegated doing the best they know how, they lose all of our experience and knowledge of what happened and how the best way to do it is. If we leave them in a situation where they're, well, I'm just going to do this the best I can and hope for the best, you know, that's really, really, we've failed, we believe. When that happens, and we teach our drivers and our technicians and our people, if you ever catch yourself saying that in a situation, that you have stop work authority. You stop right now. There's no questions asked. You're not in trouble. You'll never be in trouble. Stop, call somebody, and let's get it figured out before we proceed. That makes a big difference. So guys feel like maybe they don't know what to do. If they know that without any repercussions, they can stop.
Yeah.
And we're going to help them, you know, then that's good. There's still some folks who, you know, are try to be self-reliant, and we always ask, we had an issue this week. I don't want to go into it because it's horrible. But, I mean, nobody's hurt or anything, but expensive. And the guy, all he had to do was stop and say, I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
Right.
But he didn't. He guessed. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the results were catastrophic. So, you know, if you don't know, just stop and ask somebody. At Shipley, nobody's going to drive you to do something you're not sure or you don't want to do. You don't feel it's safe. We're going to stop.
Yeah.
So I don't know what other training there might be, Matt. I'm sure you guys do some too.
No, I was going to touch on the train-the-trainer program that Andy put together, which was really fantastic. Because we had a lot of guys that have been here for a long time that were training, but this guy might train different than this guy would. Yeah. So you'd end up with two different drivers depending on who trained who, you know. So that kind of unified our training a little bit. Going back to what you said too, though, about like the delivery processes and, you know, making sure they have somebody to call. I ran into that instance when I was driving where I got to a tank, I wasn't sure it was going to fit. And, you know, you're taught early on that no matter what a dispatcher puts on a load, whatever, it comes back to the driver if you end up with a spill with an
sure
issue.
Does.
So it's your livelihood that's out there if you're not taking precaution. I wasn't sure if the load was going to fit. And so now I was on the phone for an hour and a half with multiple people before I was comfortable dropping that fuel, and it worked out. Talked to a driver who had been there multiple times in the past, and but you know, just giving those guys, making them understand, like, hey, look, don't be afraid to call somebody. Like, don't just do it because I think so. Like, we're not dealing with you know, nacho cheese or anything. We're dealing with gasoline. You can't just put this all over the ground.
Yep.
You know, it's it's
Matt, I got 1,000 gallons of nacho cheese on the ground over here.
So it's
bring some chips and some absorbent.
Right. So it's they need to be conscientious of what they're doing out there and make sure that they feel that they have that comfort that then they can call somebody if there's something wrong.
And so this is what Matt's really good about, because if you're going to have that be the way it is, like if we're going to tell guys and mean it, call me.
Right.
When they call or talk to you about anything else or they need to talk to you, you can't be a jerk.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like they can't see you coming and want, and this definitely applies to safety. They can't see you coming and want to turn and go the other way, right? Because, oh no, here comes that Whitmer guy. Oh, he's going to browbeat, you know, or management by nagging or whatever the case may be, or, you know, safety. We always say safety is a resource, not a police force.
Right.
So that we're not like doing that to guys, because if we do that to them, if Matt doesn't treat his guys with dignity and respect that they deserve,
yes,
when they need to call him, they will not. And so for us as a philosophy, as a company, is that we treat people really, really well because we want you to call when you're not sure. And we don't want any barriers to that. Right. So, and a barrier to that is, you know, driver thinks, you know, Matt's a jerk and doesn't want to talk to him.
Right.
And we can't have that.
And that's where having a great driving team comes into play too, because there's going to be sometimes I've been out of driving here for 6 years now. So you know, there might be a question for a driver that they're going to answer better than I do about how, you know, what the tanks are at that station or whatnot. And you can call drivers that are off shift and I'm like, yeah, I'll call them quick. You know, you know, they're the experts out there really at the end of the day. So having those guys available to be like, you know, be a resource for these guys and not, you know, help the next, you know, generation, quote unquote, along. Yeah. Like it's a big deal. You know, it's great to have that, that type of team behind us. So.
And I'm curious, as a safety net, especially on the transportation side, is there safety technology that you use in the trucks? I know a lot of long hauls, they might use forward-facing, backward-facing cameras, other equipment, whether they use it for training, even telematic devices, things like that. What do you guys use?
We have forward-facing and driver-facing cameras. Yeah. We use, on the other side, Omnitrax?
Yeah, we have Motive on our transport side and Omnitrax on our residential side.
Yep.
So we don't love that we have two different systems, but we're stuck with that for at least a couple more years, and then we'll reconsider what we're doing. But you know, we go out of the way, out of our way. First of all, we reward them for doing things right on the camera. They get an extra bonus if their performance on the camera is, you know, over a certain level. And then by the same token, what we really never ever do is browbeat them with what we see. I mean, it's easy to sit there and say, oh, we want it to be game tape, and we do.
Right.
You know, we want it, but sometimes it's hard to take a look at that and go, you know, I don't want to send this to a driver and say, hey, you know, this is such a nitpicky little thing. We really pick our battles.
It's a fine line, right?
Right. And so, and it's hard to convince guys that, you know, we really have your best interest at heart with this camera, and we're protecting the company and we're protecting you, because that camera is going to be either your prosecuting attorney or your defense attorney. And the difference in the two that determines that is you as a driver. But I get it from a driver's point of view. It's invasive and it's a change. The older drivers do have a bit more of a challenge with it, but that's the way the industry is going.
Especially insurance.
Oh, we I mean,
litigation.
Yeah, we can't ever change it. That's the thing. So, you know, how we manage it with those guys is Matt has to, he's got to really, you know, have a soft touch with it.
Yeah, it's tough because you can't do it in a way, like Andy said, that I try to tell everybody when I first talk, like, look, I'm not picking on you, like, but this is what we need to work on. Even a 20-year guy is going to have flaws that can be corrected. And that's where the coachability we talked about with recruiting really comes into play. Like, you got to be open. One of our newer drivers, he's been one of the most receptive people to his different issues. Like, he'll pop up and he'll say he doesn't have a seatbelt on. He's like, I have my seatbelt on. You can see it, you know, and he's buying into it. You know, I've had more guys call us. We switched camera systems recently, and we have more guys call and, like, say, hey, look, I saw this on the camera, you know, whereas they didn't get that before. It didn't go to their phone right away, where now it does. And they'll call in and say this issue. Like, that driver specifically constantly have seatbelt issues, even though he had it on. He bought a silver reflective thing now that goes so he can, you know, make sure that he's not getting seatbelt violations, which we can expunge those, too, like, if we see that it's something that's not there. The technology that they're coming up with for some of these things are, you know, it makes us safer, but it does, you know, we talked about not make sure they don't feel like they're picked on too.
Right.
So it's,
yeah, no, it's totally fair.
You know, and we're not doing this yet at Shipley. We will at some point. Done this with other companies in the past. When we put cameras in trucks, we put cameras in offices.
Oh, fair.
You know, there's not going to be a camera in the CEO's office, let's be honest, but there'll be a camera in common work areas or certain areas, because one of the things that always comes back to you is, well, you don't have a camera. Well, yes, I do. Yeah, we all do.
It's the same thing with, like, commercial professional drivers versus just everybody else on the road. They should have a telematic device too. Maybe they should have speed limiters too. You know, it's a fair argument.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you think about some of the people out there driving, and we know that a vast majority of the events that happen between a four-wheeler and a truck are the fault of the amateur driver.
Right.
Yep.
You know, we've only had 3 DOT accidents in the last 3 years, and all 3 of them were blatantly the fault of the other vehicle. Yep. Like, run directly in the back of us, run directly through a stop sign and hit us, do something where we're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, and that's where that data queue process comes in. Some of them you can data queue and get removed, and some you can't. And that's fine. But, you know, We because we have a CDL, I tell the drivers this all the time, because you have a CDL and because you're the professional, whether you like it or not, you have an obligation to look out for the other person on the road because they're an amateur and driving for them is a means to an end. It's to get from point A to point B, and they don't think about how they drive.
Yep.
They just are getting there. But you're a professional and you do think about how you drive, and you know, it doesn't make you responsible for everything that happens, but you need to view it as your responsibility to take care of them on the road as well as yourself. Sometimes you can't. But if you take that approach, you find yourself being more courteous, managing your space better, doing all the things that you need to do. And that's really important. And it seems easy, but it's not. It's not. When you're out there 70 hours a week as a driver, that can be hard.
Yeah. It's easy to get complacent sometimes. Yeah. You know, and that's where we can help reel them, you know, not reel them back in, but help them notice their faults if they have them, you know. So...
No, that's a perfect point. And I think it's a great transition. I do want to eventually start talking about regulation changes. There's stuff with safety, crashes and things like that, preventability. But I think we're going to take a quick break, get out of the seats, grab some water, and then we can come dive back into it.
CNS Driver Training Center has just changed the status quo and has completely disrupted the current landscape of CDL training. What makes our CDL school diploma programs different? We want to be cost-effective and flexible for you, the trainee, not the school. Our driver training center is up to 40% cheaper than competitor programs, which focus on training students in groups, not the one-on-one training like us. Who wants to learn how to be a professional driver crammed in the back of a truck with a group of trainees? Ron, get off of me! We offer classroom and online theory training to better accommodate your availability. We developed this from inception so you have the most impactful learning experience. CNS is the first school to be approved by our state for one-on-one Class A CDL training. Our one-of-a-kind CDL training program is designed with the trainee in mind. How? Because the program is specifically focused on the trainee's current aptitude, learning style, and desired job outcome. We're all about delivering high-quality professional truck drivers to our industry in a timely and cost-effective manner. So why wouldn't you choose CNS for your CDL training? Give us a call at 717-496-9145 or email us at support@cnstrains.com. Or you can fill out the form below and somebody will be in contact with you soon.
So as far as, you know, whether it's safety, drivers, you know, you got the DOT regulations, FMCSA, a lot of regulations out there. Obviously, hazmat adds another layer of regulations on that. You know, again, whether it's safety record, crash and inspection records, you guys are doing amazing. What do you, or how do you look at FMCSA? What's your perspective with those, with the organization and with regulations in general?
So the way we approach regulations is this. Being compliant doesn't make you safe. Being compliant only makes you compliant.
Correct.
The reason you are compliant is not because you're worried about an audit or a government group coming in to see you. Like the FMCSA or OSHA or anybody, they can come audit us tomorrow. I fear no audit. You know, what the worst that can happen in that situation is they come in, they find a few things, they write us up a fine, and we fix it and we move on. But it does not interrupt our ability to operate. And my experience with audits, particularly with FMCSA, is once they get in there and see that you're honestly, you're doing most of it right and you're trying really hard to make sure you do it right, you're not their target. They move on quickly to somebody. They want the outlaw. They're looking for that company. So because of that, we don't really fear them. But we comply for really a different reason. And the reason we have to be compliant is if we're not compliant, that puts us at risk for litigation, right? I mean, you know, we fear plaintiff's attorneys. We don't fear them, but we dread them, so to speak. And that's the reason to be compliant, because when you're not compliant, if a plaintiff attorney gets a hold of that, then they can shut us down. They can keep us from being able to get insurance. They can make us negligent. And if we have one of these nuclear verdicts with a huge amount of, you know, punitive damages are not insurable.
Right.
So that your company's getting the checkbook out and writing that. I mean, Compensatory damages, that your insurance is going to cover that, you know, depending on what your coverage is and how much the damages are. But the punitive damages, you're paying those. And that's going to stop your ability to operate. It could potentially stop your ability to operate. So we comply. It's obviously the right thing to do. But we comply because that keeps us, you know, that mitigates our risk. We don't comply because, you know, people go all the time. I hear people say, well, we better do that. You might get audited. Audit me. Come on. I don't care. Bring it on. You know, and it's not that, you know, we want to tempt fate with them. We love you. FMCSA auditors. But the fact of the matter is that's not where the real risk for us lies. So when we comply, that's the approach we take. You know, we learn the other thing that we say, and I tell this to drivers in our training, and I say it all the time, do not try to logic your way through the regulations. And the reason is the regulations don't make logical sense. A different group of people make them, they grow, they change as political parties change in the White House and appointed positions change at the DOT. The direction of the regulations can change, and it moves slowly, but it does move over time.
Yeah.
And if you're out there working, you think, well, it seems like this would be the right regulation, you're going to do something wrong and be out of compliance. And most of the time it happens because Matt would look at it as a tanker guy or a guy hauling beer, and he doesn't realize that when a regulator writes that rule, they have to write it for everybody. And yep. So it's going to be written in a much more broad or different perspective. And so don't try to figure the regulations out or use logic to be compliant. What you need to do is learn the rules. Don't question them, because that's just going to drive you nuts, and then play by them. And that's what we do.
And obviously one of the things we preach is proactive safety. So it's not only are the rules there, that's like the base minimum. Really, right.
That's the baseline.
And especially when it comes to whether it's insurance or when it comes to litigation, they're not looking at, are you complying with the base minimum? You should be, and that's fine. They'll find something else to complain. Why aren't you doing what everybody else is doing? Like, hey, bigger fleets have cameras. Luckily, you guys got cameras and using that. I'm curious, too. You mentioned you being deposed?
Yeah.
Yes. Disposed, like toss him out.
Matt wishes that I could be disposed.
But I'm just curious, what's that process like? How do you prepare for when events like that happen? I'm sure medium and larger fleets out there are always curious about this process.
Well, sure. I mean, something bad's happened if you're going to be deposed. Right. And, you know, we're just trying to fact gather.
Yeah.
And the critical part about the deposition is that's really where they're trying to determine negligence on behalf of the company and what really actually happened. And so, you know, when you're talking about risk management and the litigation side of it, as important as the regulations are your company policies. Because if you don't follow your company policies, you make yourself negligent. Yep. And, you know, we always talk about innocent until proven guilty. That's the criminal standard, right? Well, the civil standard for negligence is known or should have known. So the question that we have to ask each other all the time, and Matt and I, we do this exercise. Hey, you know, did you know or should you have known that this guy's a problem? Because if you have to answer that under oath,
yeah,
then guess what? We're going to be negligent. If we knew or we should have known that, we're going to be negligent. So we have to follow our own policies. Our policies have to be clear. There's an art to writing a policy that gives you a little bit of wiggle room.
Right.
Right. We use very little wills and a whole lot of may, right? Very little we will terminate you if, and a whole lot of we may terminate you if. That way, if we decide not to terminate somebody, we haven't violated our policy.
Right.
So if we violate our policy and hire a guy that we say we won't hire, our standard says you must be, this is for example, 22 years old. And we hire a 21-year-old, and he goes out and 5 years later, when he's 28, he's in an accident and he kills somebody. A good plaintiff attorney is going to say, you hired him improperly, and if you had followed your own processes, he wouldn't have been here to have this accident. And we can't really argue with that. It makes us negligent. So, you know, you have to follow your own rules. Yeah. And that's like the real challenge with the whole thing. There's so many different things that can happen. And so when you're getting ready for a deposition, you get prepped and you know what's going on. There's certain things you want to know about, and, you know, there's some things you'd love to not be able to know about or hope that they don't answer. But you just have to be honest and not be intimidated, because you're going to get asked the same question four different ways.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, your nature is, when somebody asks you that question over and over, well, maybe I'm not telling you what you want to hear, so you change your answer. You just got to give them the same answer. You got to give them the same answer. Remember, they're not there to help you.
Right.
They're not there to help you. And they're actually there to hurt you. So, you know, you don't want to be combative, but you don't have to be, you know, their friend. You just answer honestly because you're required to, but don't say anything you don't have to.
Right.
It's a challenge. It takes, you know, and they have like an hour's of service for that too. You can only be, I tell people this all the time, you can only be on the stand for 9 hours.
Interesting.
In 9 hours. I mean, all right, well, think about that. If somebody wants to browbeat you for 9 hours, that's a long time to have to keep your mind focused on something and straight. And they don't necessarily do that to the safety guy. They're going to do that to the driver.
Yep.
That's who they're going to try to get him to say something. You know, they talk to me. They know, we're not going to trick him with this X, Y, or Z, but let's talk to this driver over here and see what can happen. That's who they'll go after.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm curious, you know, especially on the insurance side. So you say it's like a 6-month process for you, whether it's transportation or the hazmat pieces of it. What's the kind of prep that you do, or how does safety work with helping keeping premiums reduced?
So at Shipley, we're in a thing called a captive.
Okay.
All right. And the way a captive works, if for those of us who, or those of you who may not be familiar, we and 400 or 500 other companies, we all contribute a certain amount of money into a pool, and we basically insure each other, so we're self-insured.
Nice.
So the way that works is we pay for all of our own things, but the way the laws are written, you can't just be self-insured. You have to have paper insurance. So right. Then there's a whole bunch of legal things that go on in the background in which our captive insurance is given – like legitimate insurance. So for us, what we say is our Zurich is our on paper insurer.
Yeah.
But you know, we have so much money into it, and all the companies that are involved have so much into it, you know, that Zurich doesn't ever really get touched with it. And then we have to manage it from there. There's a bunch of different lines. So we have to, you know, we have to be able to explain to the actuarial team from our captive.
Yep.
What our actual risk is. And that's based on our payroll, the number of buildings we have, what we actually do, our drivers. There's a huge, long set of information that has to be gathered for them every year and sent to them. And it's largely based on your performance on the previous years. So a couple of years ago, we've had some record-setting good performances for 3 or 4 years. But a couple of years ago, within 4 days of each other, we had a guy fall off of a ladder making a delivery, and it was $500,000 claim.
Wow.
I mean, dude could not remember his name for like 6 weeks. Like, it really messed him up. Could not remember his wife, couldn't remember his children. Like, the guy's legitimately hurt. Yep. And so that was a problem. And then 4 days later, you know, we own the York Revolution. So under the Shipley Group, York Revolution, the baseball team, and a groundskeeper at the baseball team fell off a ladder and was severely injured. And I don't want to get into the personal details for any of those guys, but that one was also $500,000 claim. So, you know, our claims are run 200,000 to 300,000 a year. And in 4 days, we had $1 million worth of claims. Like, the reason that's important is that's what the insurance company looks at when they determine what your premiums are going to be.
Yeah.
Right? So anytime, this is like a word to the wise, and I hope I don't step on any toes when I say this, but anytime somebody comes to you as a vendor and says, if you do this, your insurance premiums will be reduced, that's not true.
No, it's way.
That's a sales pitch. That's just completely not true. You're not going to be able to call your insurance company and say, hey, we're using, I'm going to say Smith System. They don't say that, but we're using Smith System, so I need my insurance ready. They don't care. They're not going to reduce your insurance. There's only one thing that reduces your insurance premiums, and that's not having claims. If your claims dollars go down, your premiums will go down eventually. But anything that can happen to drive your premiums up, it will. They'll drive them up.
It's the red flags, not the
you're doing good. So yeah, no, they'll go great. Keep doing Smith System. They like that you're doing those things. Yeah. And the thing is, if you do enough of those things and you do the right ones, you will have less claims. That's why you do those things.
That's why you do
it. And that's how your insurance will come down. But if somebody's trying to sell you a system, you know, a camera system, for example, and they say, if you take this, your insurance will give you a discount. No, no, they won't. You know, they like that you're doing it, and they'll take it in consideration. But it's the not having accidents is what gets your insurance premium reduced. So the reason we're in a captive is that, you know, we're self-insured, and that means the premiums are way less. But whenever something goes wrong, we're paying for it.
Yep.
You know, and if it gets beyond a certain point, then the group will chip in and save. And the more, the better we perform, the better our premiums are.
Yep.
But it just, to do the captive, is a lot of work. I mean, it's a lot of work. It's, if you just get regular insurance, go through a broker, that's not so difficult. I mean, I've done that too.
Yeah.
And that's a whole lot easier. The captive thing is worth the time and effort because you can save a lot of money.
Actually, you know, you mentioned Shipley owning York Revolutions. There's a lot of really cool community involvement that the company does, especially on the transportation side. I mean, if there's a big, say, a hurricane down in Florida or somewhere down south, you guys go out, at least a handful of people go out there and help with that. I'm just curious whether it's regulation, safety, or just that process of helping these other people out. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's a win-win situation for us. Right. I mean, one of our mission points on our mission is to provide, you know, to be a good steward of the community, basically.
Yeah.
So the community is very important for us. And the community doesn't just have to be in York or in Lancaster or you know, Malvern or wherever we happen to be. Mm-hmm. So when there's an opportunity to go do that, it's really, really a cool chance for our drivers to go get to be a part of something special that doesn't happen every day. And we also, by the way, compensate them very, very well for it because it's that important to us to do it. So they'll go, they'll spend days. We've sent people to Miami, to New Orleans, to Houston, Corpus Christi, you know, all over the place in our little, you know, tank wagons.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an adventure. You know, you're going into it feels like they're going into a war zone.
Yeah, seriously.
And it's a very fulfilling bit of work. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of times when you're doing your job that you get to feel real altruistic about it. Yeah. And this helps our guys do that. And like I said, it's a win-win because also, by the way, you know, they get to make good money.
Right.
While they do it. So, you know, we want to be a part of that. We work directly with FEMA and some other vendors that have the interface with FEMA. And we go down, we sell fuel, we take fuel down, then we haul as much fuel as we can. Most of the time we're working directly for the military when we do it. So those are the things that happen. And it's just the guys that come back, they have great stories to tell. It's a life-changing event for them.
Yeah.
And the first year we did it was 2017, and I had to beg four guys to go.
Oh, really?
Right. And we got them. You know, they went. The last couple times, like, people are coming out of the wood. Guys who work in the office who still have their CDL are like, I want to go. You know, yeah, right. So I think we did have a dispatcher go last time. So, you know, it's really cool. It's something we look forward to, and we wish we could do it every year, but then you can't. You got to be careful about wishing that because then you don't want to wish a hurricane on the Gulf Coast. It's going to happen anyway.
But right. Seriously. Well, and I'm curious. So, dispatch side, do you have to worry about how you manage, I don't know, safe roads to get down there, whether there's flooding, whether there's anything like that?
On my side, it's mostly on the tank wagon side that we deal with it. So, it hasn't impacted us too much. I did have one guy go down to New Orleans the other year. There's definitely some routing concerns. We haven't really had to worry about the routing of getting them down there. We work with another partner too that coordinates a lot of that stuff where they'll meet up at Virginia, North Carolina somewhere and then go the rest of the way down.
We handle logistics off to Foster Fuels in Virginia and then they dispatch our guys. But what we do is we stay on top of their lodging and their location and their needs and their per diem and all the things that they need. You know, if they need to buy, a lot of times they get down there and they got to buy tools.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't ever just, set it and forget it. We're there talking to them constantly, but their day-to-day dispatch comes from a different company. Yep. And the really interesting thing is, you know, they'll go to where their staging point is in whatever, wherever the area is that's under, that has a problem. And they just have to be waiting and ready. And I had guys who actually worked on like 6 days, but were down for 21 days or 22 days. So 15 of the days, they went down there and sat next to their truck for 10 hours waiting to be sent somewhere and ended up not going anywhere that day.
Right.
So, and that's just, I mean, you know, the government at work, I suppose, but it's not an easy thing for FEMA to organize all that. So I don't judge. But I mean, the fact of the matter is we need fuel for this side or the other, and we don't want to, in the military, they don't want to let that fuel go to some private thing in case they need it. So, you know, they'll go sit, but they show up, they wait. They started taking lawn chairs and books and, you know, music and things like that to keep themselves entertained because they might be sitting there all day. And then other times they go, and because the hours of service get waived,
yep,
and all those things happen, then they might be down there working 20-hour days.
Yeah.
You know, but it's either way, they come back raving about what a great experience it is. So we're really happy that they get to do it. And you know, we're proud too. I mean, we brag about it, and it warms our heart.
It sounds like to me, being from the West Coast, all the wildfires and stuff that we have out there, it's sort of the same thing. They dispatch with another so it's just, that's interesting. It's fascinating. So jumping into regulations a little bit, some new things that are coming down the pike, FMCSA proposing speed limiter rule. I'm just curious, love it, hate it?
Well, there's not a mile per hour front. Go ahead, man.
They haven't gotten,
I think we talked about off air, but you worry about getting the safety issue of it, of getting traffic getting backed up because the truck can only go, 59 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour when everybody's flying around you. And how the impacts it has there on just regular traffic flow.
And it'll have an impact beyond just that. I mean, we know that the variability of the traffic flow is a big problem.
Right.
I mean, drivers have stated that, and I promise you the FMCSA is aware of that. Like, it's not a secret. But if you project that forward, it's going to impact manufacture of trucks.
Yeah.
And so when you buy a truck, a new truck will come standard at that with that setting, and to override that or overrule it will be a challenge if you were so, wanting, and some people will. And then the other challenge with that then is, we want to get cleaner trucks on the road. Well, a speed limiter rule is going to mean a lot of independent operators keep their old truck.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
ELD
did the same thing, and so did 2010 when the emission standards changed.
Yep.
I mean, everybody that could get grandfathered in is just running those trucks as long as they can. And so those kinds of things happen. You know, the speed limiter rule, to me, it comes up every few years, and it never seems to work itself out, so I don't really sweat it. You know, and the thing I'll say about it is the big companies are already doing it.
Right.
And if you're a new driver into the industry, you're probably going to have to go through a big company to get your career started. In most cases, it's not that big of a deal. Just do what the truck does. Don't worry about it. I always felt it was more relaxing to get in the right lane and roll down the road at 63 than to try to be, weaving in and out of traffic and getting past this guy or that guy or the other. You know, if you don't have lane restrictions or dedicated highways, I don't know how the speed limiting thing's going to work. Honestly,
I agree. And especially, it's always interesting too, because it's like they set such a hard number, but some states, I mean, when we came over from Oregon, we drove over and Wyoming, wide open,
right?
The roads are a lot faster. It should be more of a variable thing, I think, than more than here's a strict number. So it's just, I don't know. I just feel like the approach, while I understand where they're coming from, I think one, drivers should know, again, whether that variability, what's the traffic going, that seems to be more safe. And then two, if you want to get better miles per gallon, you're going to be going slower anyway. So it's like,
if you already care about that, you're already going slow.
Yeah.
We teach our drivers to drive slightly slower than the flow of traffic.
Yeah.
And that's what we want you to do. If you're going too fast or faster than the flow of traffic, you're forever, well, first of all, it takes you longer to stop. And then you're always closing. If you're going faster than traffic, you're always reducing your following distance.
Right.
So that's a double whammy. So that's why if you're going slightly slower than traffic, you're always extending your following distance. That's good, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't need as far to stop. So, but we don't want you to be a hindrance
yes.
to the people around you. And if there's a speed limiter rule, I promise you there's a driver out there who's going to swing in the left lane and create the rolling roadblock.
Yep.
And there'll be road rage incidents, and there'll be things that happen. And well, I mean, it's not going to be Armageddon or anything.
Right.
But it just doesn't seem like, you know, we talked about the one size fits all. It doesn't really work for our industry. So varied with the different niches of like tankers or animal movements or whatever, beer, whatever the case may be, right?
Right.
And you can't just say, well, everybody do this, and it be workable.
Yeah. Sense. All right. Well, hey, guys, thank you so much. We're going to wrap it up here. A lot of great information that we were chatting about. And thank you all for coming. If you guys have any questions for them online, fill out, write something up in the comments. We can pass it down, and I'm sure they'd be willing to try to answer any of your questions. If you've got questions on whether it's regulatory changes, or if you want to pay attention about other new things that are coming down the pike, be sure to subscribe, like the video, share it, and give Shipley a thumbs up. They got a YouTube channel as well. They can be found on social. And if you are looking for a trucking career, check out cnstrains.com. We have their job postings there. I'm sure they have job postings on their website as well. Thanks for joining us, and stay safe out there.